Good morning again. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat. I hope everybody's doing well on this hot Friday in Ontario. I think temperature is going to climb to mid-30s today, I'm hearing. We are July 3rd, and today on beautiful, lovely Friday here. It's sunny, it's beautiful. And here's something, you know, we're gonna do another recording. As you can tell from me showing up on camera, I don't show up for just to report the weather. Obviously, I show up to tell you that we are going to record another episode. So today's episode is number 246. And thanks for joining me on this journey of recording this particular episode. Here's something I don't say often enough on this show. And actually, just this morning's recording, I was just talking about the same topic as well. Some of the most interesting operators and CEOs and executives that came into the localization industry did not come from the localization industry. They came in from the outside. They saw what we couldn't see because we were too close to it. And they started building differently. Today's guest walked out of a career of private equity, distressed debt, corporate finance turnarounds, the kind of work where you called in when things are already broken and decided to acquire a language service company. That's not a pivot. That's a thesis. And then we're going to get into that thesis in a second here. I want to know what that thesis is for my guest today and whether the industry lived up to it. And for those of you who don't know me, Robin Ayoub, and I am the host and the publisher of the Localization Fireside Chat. Let's bring in Brogan Taylor. Good friend, Brogan Taylor, my Ontario resident, although 2 hours away from me, I consider you a neighbor because I think you're the closest podcast guest that I've had on this one for a while now. So
probably, I was almost going to suggest that we should do this like together, like in real life.
You know, I'd love to do that. Again, I've done them from cafes, from driving on highways. For those of you who watch this channel, you've seen me recording driving on the highway in Ontario and recording podcasts. We should be able to do this one-on-one sometime. Brogan, I want to welcome you to the Localization Fireside Chat. Truly honored to have you with me as a guest, as a friend, as a colleague in the industry. And for anyone who's just tuning in, Brogan is a CEO of Stillman Solutions and an integrated language ops provider with operations across Americas, Europe, Egypt, delivering translation, localization, data annotation, AI tech enablement, and digital marketing under an ISO-certified roof, one ISO-certified roof. As you can see, there are many facets or many angles for Stillman, which we're going to be getting into it right now after we give the mic to my good friend Brogan here in a second. But Brogan, as we say on this channel, without diving too many, I don't want to steal too much of your thunder here. I could read the entire bio, but I'm going to leave you the room to introduce yourself if you don't mind. As we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. Let's start with this one. What's your story? What got you here?
Thank you. And let me start by just thanking you for inviting me on the podcast. It's great. I've been following you since I entered the industry back in 2022. I joke that we met back at an industry event. I think it was in Montreal, if I recall correctly. And you're like, oh, I should get you on the podcast one day. And I'm like, bit of a shy guy, and I was like, maybe I'll think about that. And it's finally we've come to it. You've convinced me to get on here, and I've been a follower from day one, or at least day one since I've been involved.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem.
My past is quite different, I would think, from the typical person in the language services industry. You mentioned before, you touched on my background. By training, I was a finance and corporate finance professional. Started my career on Bay Street here in Canada, in the corporate finance world, working for a boutique private equity firm. And for just the happenstance of the boutique that hired me, fresh out of college or university here in Canada, they were focused on distress turnarounds. So we were buying out distress companies and fixing them up, not trying to sell them off for parts, but trying to actually partner with those management teams and boards of directors to actually fix the balance sheets and then grow those businesses. So it was a real experience learning that. I feel like I got about 25 years of work experience in the 5 years of work I did that pre-credit crisis. That ultimately rolled into corporate finance consulting, which I did at one of the largest independent corporate finance consulting firms in the world called FTI Consulting. They're worldwide. listed publicly on out of the US. And I got to travel the world and do bulge bracket restructuring. So my first iteration of restructurings were kind of small mid-cap companies that we would call, but they were still quite large. And then I got to sink my teeth into airlines and oil and gas companies and oil and gas service companies and media companies and newspaper companies. And these things were monsters with cross-border operations, and got to learn all sorts of cool things along the way and build kind of a network while I did that. Ultimately decided I didn't want to get pigeonholed into the distress stuff and become a receiver or something like that. So I went back to school and got my MBA and came out of there kind of fresh and looking for some new challenges, and helped out a publicly listed ultra high net worth wealth management firm restructure operationally, but also set them up for a take private transaction. And we sold that company to a private equity firm here in Canada at the time. So that coincided with, okay, now what am I going to do with my life? I just kind of worked my way out of a job on purpose, successfully. And so I went back to the drawing board and decided I'm going to go and look for some companies that I'd be interested in running myself, and kind of get back to my original days of PE. Although I didn't want to get into the distress stuff. It's far too risky as a sole owner to do that. It's more of a fund kind of approach. But I fell in love with this industry. I had a laundry list of items I was looking for, reached out to my network to look for companies to buy. And one of my old contacts came to me with this opportunity with Stillman and said, I need somebody that can think outside the box. This thing is, it's really cool. It has a great founder. It's been around for, at the time, over 10 years. But really need somebody to take it to the next level. The founder was adamant that he wanted to focus on more of a startup situation. And so he was ready to move on and transition the business to a new owner that could maybe level it up. So I fell in love with the industry because it ticked so many of my boxes. Actually, it ticked every single one of the boxes. And what I was looking for was companies that were instantaneously global. You could grow. And basically, I was looking for a large enough sandbox that I could be creative within and be able to compete and find value and provide value to clients in many different ways. And I think the localization industry is just perfect for that. I guess, lo and behold, the surprise to me was in mid-2022, when we closed the acquisition, the industry really got kind of flipped upside down. It got disrupted almost immediately with new technology and AI chatbots that came out. And ever since, it's always been, okay, how do we grapple with this extreme change and disruption in the industry? So it's been a steep learning curve for me, not only in the language services industry, but had to quickly backtrack to my good old days and put on my corporate restructuring hat and say, okay, well, how do we compete and where are we going to survive, and where is this going? With very little information, just like anybody else, because we didn't know what things were going to happen with all this new technology. And so so I did what I did best. And we went back to our core, looked internally and said, okay, what do we do really great? And what made me fall in love with Stillman? And what I really believed in is what's true today is what our core people, our team, are extremely good at: workflow and process management. And so we looked at that as the foundation of the call. I use this analogy all the time, like you're building a skyscraper, you need a solid foundation. And so if we can lean into that solid foundation of workflow and process management and efficiencies as our foundation, our bedrock, that's our skill set and that's our value that we bring to our clients, then how can we build from that? And then setting up the pillars of success. So I'll maybe turn it back to you, Robin, as I could go on forever, but I think...
No, that's fine. This is all wonderful. I'm enjoying hearing the story. Because, you know, somebody like you who've been exposed, as you mentioned earlier, you started your career in working with various types of companies, various types of industries. You've touched on, paper companies, oil and gas, a variety of other companies. To see you ending up in the language industry, you must have had a conversation with yourself, or you must have looked, oh, I can't buy an oil company. Maybe a translation company is more suitable. What was the fork in the road for you? You decided, from all the industries out there, this industry is mine. Because the industry to us, from the outside looking in, having been through mergers and acquisitions several times, it looks very exciting, very interesting from the outside looking in. You know, the world is global. Everybody needs to communicate. Languages cannot be a barrier. That's a big problem. We need to solve that. The language industry solves that. But once you're inside the industry looking from within now, you're starting to see a few things that are a little different. You've had a soul search or something? How did that come about?
Well, I think, you touched on it already. I completely agree with you. From the outside looking in, it's an incredibly attractive industry. It's naturally global. It ticked all those boxes I had on my laundry list. Something that is a huge sandbox. You can create, you can sit in one corner and be just niche and excellent at one thing and be very successful, or you can be more broad and play in all sorts of different areas of that sandbox and compete and win. And it's extremely fragmented. There's a lot of players, very big players, but also very small mom and pop shop kind of players. And
19,000 companies.
And there's room for success for everyone. So it's very attractive. That being said, now that I'm inside, or after I became an insider in the industry, and with this disruption that hit us back in 2022 and ever since, I find myself like, oh my gosh, what did I get myself into? And maybe it was a bit of soul searching, but I think it was more of a confidence in my business acumen to say, if it ticked all the boxes to begin with, this thing is not dead. This industry is definitely not dead. This industry is just going to thrive. And I think that there is room to grow almost exponentially from what it was before. And that you just have to find where that opportunity lies. And if I think back to my restructuring days of truly distressed companies.
Because that was my next question.
If I think back to my restructuring of truly distressed companies, how did we fix them? And how did we not just sell them off for parts and try to like recover some debt? It was really focusing on what was the core value of that business to begin with? What were they successful at before they got into trouble? And whether those were external market factors that got them into trouble, or management team that overleveraged their balance sheet and got them into trouble. And that overleverage may have been because they were pushing into a new market or pushing into a new product category or something that got them off track and away from their core value proposition, was mainly the issues. And so we did a lot of retrenching when we restructured distressed companies. And so that's my approach with Stillman too, was looking back at, okay, what do we do very well? And what's at the core of our value prop? And again, that was the team offering these value added workflow and process management solutions. And then, okay, how do we build on top of that? And how do we compete in this new world? And so that's where we started going with the Stillman Solutions brand to provide more integrated language operation solutions. And those kind of stem from two main pillars, and that's accessibility, which is never going to go away. You always need to communicate in different languages. And we're focused mainly in healthcare, life sciences, education, and legal sectors, because those are very insulated, very, there's a moat around those industries or those sectors that you're never going to get away from the need for multilingual language accessibility. And then where we can build further on just the kind of the lowest totem pole or the lowest rung on the ladder, so to speak, of just plain accessibility is then comes into play like mass customization, all the nuance that you can kind of implement into that accessibility. And then on top of that, it's can you actually deliver more than just translation localization? And that's where we immediately, after I acquired Stillman, created a team in-house called the Stillman Factory, which is a digital marketing agency. Now, I'm not a genius and I don't see everything perfectly. And so I'll admit that we started that as an internal agency to go sell marketing services to our existing clients, which were other LSPs and MLVs at the time. And they had no interest. So we built up this incredible team of wonderful people that were creative strategists, marketing strategists, digital marketing experts, design experts, with the blend of the analytics and delivering the data behind those marketing initiatives. So we had this amazing team and we couldn't sell it to our existing clients. So then we had to go find somebody to sell it to. So we started marketing to other just direct clients. And so we picked up a few along the way. But I think I always say there's a lot of luck in business. And I think now that I look back and we're kind of 4 years into this journey of this evolution of ours, as we're building out these integrated language ops solutions, part of this pillar of accessibility is providing that content generation ability as well with our clients. And so now it's not just taking their content and translating it and localizing it into another language. It's actually working with them to create new content and making it global from the outset and being able to deliver that in multi languages. So it's a very key piece to what we're doing. And it was a complete fluke. I must credit my team for having the perseverance to continue on with that vision, and we still service some direct clients with some marketing needs, and that's a big part of what we do on the TSF team, but it's an integral piece of what we're doing on the bigger strategy of delivering language accessibility. Now on the other pillar of this, building up this skyscraper or fortress, if you want to call it that, is governance. And that term is thrown around a ton these days, but it's extremely important in terms of security, privacy, data sovereignty, and then stretching a bit further or moving up the rungs of that ladder again, or building that pillar up. It's really about data and analytics again, and delivering that knowledge behind the language access that you're providing these types of clients. So a lot of these clients, just for example purposes, is like large hospital networks in the US that we're working with are talking about, I've never been able to articulate how much impact the language accessibility has on my patient outcomes. And so now we can come to them with solutions that actually provide them data that we can then analyze and then actually prove the worth of the spend on these language accessibility programs that they have, reducing patient readmission to the hospital, reducing time in beds, improving patient outcomes through better communication, which is what we're all about in that sector for sure. And I think part of that governance is providing the security around the solutions that you're providing, obviously protecting everyone's private information, data sovereignty when it's a need in that industry. And it's a need in Canada and the US and Europe. So making sure that you're compliant with all their compliance requirements, but then adding to that and giving them additional benefits through this data and analytics that they've never really had available to them before. So again, I could go on forever on this stuff.
But no, that's fine. That's okay. One of the conversation I was having this morning is, you know, as a language industry, we cannot be just a vendor anymore. Nobody wants a vendor anymore. They want partners. And for partners is we need to be part of the business outcome. You need to take responsibility. We need to take responsibility of that outcome. Absolutely. We can't be just on the outside looking in. We need to be inside of the business process. And in order for us to be, you know, just like my early podcast, I was just recording this thing. And my advice to the listeners out there, if you want to be part of the business process of your customer, to participate in the positive outcome to their business, you need to listen more and talk less if you are trying to sell to your customer. Ask the famous question, what keeps you up at night, Mr. Customer? And try to solve to that. And if you're not trying to solve to that, your customer is not going to listen to you, because then you become one of the pieces of the muds that you try to stick on the wall and it doesn't. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, because you went through a bunch of transformation, you bought a company and, you know, you come from that distressed assets, if you will, and you must have took the company like in a completely different direction where it is right now from you bought it. So which parts of the company you would have thought by then, today, you would have thought, okay, well, those were distressed items, I don't want them in my organization. I want to shed them or I want to transform them or I want to take them in a different directions than what it is right now.
So that's an interesting question. So originally it wasn't a distress opportunity. Stillman was quite profitable. It was
of course
a healthy company.
No, I was just using your language
from the finance days. So I'm just saying, like, my first thesis, I guess, for the acquisition and the strategy going forward with Stillman was just to grow the existing business. It was the disruption from the market and the new technologies that were coming to market that really forced us to say, oh, we need to change. Because back to your previous point that you were just talking about, which I 100% agree with, we realized that we were a vendor in a very commoditized business that was becoming more and more commoditized if all we did was provide the translation services as a vendor. And that's what Stillman was at the time, was a vendor to other LSPs and MLVs. And that still today is core to our business. So we still do a lot of that. It's a big part of what we do. We do it under the Stillman Translations brand. And we're proud to say that we have many of the biggest and smallest LSPs in the world that are our clients. And it was from doing that and being able to integrate into their workflows, albeit very different and disparate from each other. So this is where I kind of get back to like our operational team is so core to what we do, because what they've done forever is been able to adapt and integrate and create workflows and processes that are different for almost every one of our clients. And this kind of mass customization of workflows and processes and efficiencies is core to what we do. And so what we had to do is reflect on, okay, if that's core to what we do, and that's our value prop in our core business, traditional translation localization, how do we take that to this new strategy of integrated language ops? And it's leaning into that and saying, okay, well, if we do that so well, why don't we bring that to these clients and hear their business challenges, if you want to call it that, and say, we can solution around that. And if, even if they're articulating that their challenge is just a translation challenge, it ultimately comes down quickly as you peel the layers of the onion away. It becomes a workflow process, integration, process management, and efficiency problem. And that's where we decided we're going to lean in really heavily, and we're not going to develop our own technology and train our own machine translation engines or develop a large language model or anything like that. We're going to leave that up to those technology experts, but we're going to partner with the best in breed of those so that we can deliver solutions to our clients that actually solve their business needs. And those solutions might be different for every use case they have. So some of these organizations that we work with are quite broad, and they have very many different use cases. And a lot of them come to us because they talk to one vendor or tech vendor, and it solved one solution really well, but it didn't solve 13 other ones that they also had. And so they said, well, we need more of a partner that comes to us and says, I'm technology agnostic, I say. We can partner, or we have partnerships with many different technology vendors that we can then lean on and say, okay, this solution fits this use case perfectly for you, as we understand the challenges of our clients, and then can properly build the workflow and process around that challenge to solve their problem in the most efficient manner as possible.
Brogan, you talked also earlier, you mentioned, well, actually, one of the services I saw for Stillman is data annotation is listed alongside of translation and localization in your service stack. Is this still unusual pairing for most LSPs, do you think, or is that a strategic bet on where AI training demand is going?
It was really just a response demand. In fact, it was since we have such a large roster of other LSPs and MLVs, we were starting to be asked for data annotation services. And so we looked at those requests and we started developing those services around that and started providing it to other types of entities outside of LSPs and MLVs. But it really was kind of demand driven, which is kind of the best way to evolve. It's nice to build a solution that you already have demand for, as opposed to trying to predict what that demand might be and try to build a solution to fit it. It's the old adage of inside out thinking. So let's not think of what they might need and try to build something. Let's ask them what they need, and then let's make a solution or build a service around that. So that was really demand driven. We saw a big uptick in that a couple of years ago. Maybe like 18 months to 24 months ago. And we still do some quite large projects that are highly demanding in terms of throughput and productivity wise to provide those kind of data annotation services. So it's not the easiest thing to do in the world. It takes a village to be able to manage some of these projects. And again, our operations teams do a fantastic job of doing that. So that was very much a internal solution that was really developed by our operations staff, as opposed to like a sales and marketing type of initiative, really.
And is data annotation, in your opinion, still a thing now?
It is. We're still being demanded for it. It's still being asked to do it.
So it has not been automated yet?
Hasn't been automated. I think in essence, I think it's a piece of automating it. We're helping them automate it in some respects. We're training the machines that are learning from the data, but they can't be trained unless the data is annotated and they understand what the data is that they're being trained on. So it's a bit of a, maybe a circular.
You know, I've done a couple of podcasts with companies that do software, and that software is dedicated for automating the annotation piece. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's what I was asking the question. I was curious. There must be still a room for the, you know, the human driven annotation versus the automated driven annotation, because I'm assuming there's the error ratio, garbage in, garbage out in a lot of cases. And if you want pure data, because any output is as good as the data that you're feeding it. So I guess it goes back to the quality of the annotation in a lot of cases.
That and just like any kind of language model, even just for like translation purposes, sometimes you always need a human in the loop. I shouldn't say sometimes. Most of the time you need a human in the loop somewhere along the way. So what we're providing in terms of the humans in the loops of those automated processes is an aspect to that as well.
Now, you know, I'm just so baffled. Like, you know, for the audience listening in on this conversation, just to give you an idea, right, what Brogan did. So Brogan advised Gluskin chefs board through their full operational transformation, which ended up in the Onyx acquisition. To go from that, you know, for those of you who are not from the country, not from Canada, looking from the outside in, Onyx in Canada is one of the largest organizations in the country. And I would put it at the top 10, Brogan, top 15, maybe in that zone. It's a pretty large organization. To go from this to running an I don't want to call you an LSP, probably you're not an LSP at this point, a language op, we'd call it language op company in London, Ontario. I think there's a dramatic shift for you. How did you do that?
I went from the big, tall, white building on Bay Street corner office.
That's what I was going to say. You lived in Toronto. You're a Bay Street guy.
I was. Well, this is kind of what instigated this whole like, maybe I want to get back to what I really love doing. And that was like owning a company and driving change and strategy. And that's what really kind of, encouraged me to go after something for my own account. And so this just happened to be the right deal at the right time that came across. I looked at over probably 100 different companies or opportunities through my extensive network at the time. I fell in love with the founder of Stillman first. Credit to
there's chemistry number one, right?
Yeah, credit to the intermediary that was trying to connect us said, if this kind of high level briefing makes sense to you and he's like, it checks all your boxes. He's like, you need to meet the founder. And if you guys don't get along, this is never going to work. And we got along from day one. From the first moment we met, we said, His purpose was and what he wanted as an outcome perfectly aligned with what I was looking for. He was completely open book in terms of allowing me to do due diligence on the company, meet with the people on the team. He was so passionate about what he had built, but at the same time, ready to kind of transition and move that on to somebody else. So without that alignment, I think I've talked about this on some panels. If anyone's seen me at some ALC summit events or WorldSpeak M&A panels, so talking about kind of that experience with the founder of Stillman Translations, I don't think I had ever gone through an M&A experience that smoothly. And I think credit to the founder and the intermediary that we were working with, just by being so transparent and open and communicative at the beginning and throughout the process.
No, Brogan, Stillman currently operates in the Americas, in Europe, and in Egypt. How did that geographic footprint came together, and what does it do today for you that a single location or a single region doesn't let you do?
Great question. So originally, when Stillman was originally founded in 2011, we're just over 15 years now, it was founded in Argentina and predominantly a provider of Spanish translations, which expanded over the years to over 180 different languages. And the client base grew extensively from small LSPs to MLVs and some of the largest MLVs in the world. And just by the nature of those demands comes different time zone coverages, different language coverages. And so building out the operations team, project managers in different locations and time zones to service those clients and line up with their demands made sense. But also selling into the Americas, mainly North America, made sense, but also expanding into Europe made sense just for additional language pairings. And having a team in Egypt helps us in the Middle East with some of the Arabic languages and stuff like that as well. So that just made kind of sense over time. And as we lean into more of these language solutions that we're doing, still focused on those markets. So it still continues to make sense.
Does it help you in the around the clock kind of an operation? Around the sun operation?
Absolutely. So a lot of our clients request that we are able to accept jobs or at least correspond with them and help them navigate any questions or issues that they might be having with any of the projects that they have on the go. And so having people in separate time zones, and we create teams of project managers and client-facing individuals that then can kind of take over from each other at the end of their day, and the next one begins, and it kind of rolls through so that you have seamless kind of coverage.
Now, Stillman is an ISO-certified company, right? Which takes a real investment to achieve. I mean, I've been involved in a few of those and maintain. It costs money to implement some of these certifications in. Now, you coming from finance, how did you see certification in this industry? Is it a cost center, a competitive moat, or perhaps a client acquisition tool?
This is a great question, because my original thought was exactly that, like, let's cut that cost. I was coming from industries that, yes, had regulations, or experience in industries with heavy regulations, and it was clear that you need to be razor focused on the required regulations and maybe be very prudent on the non-required ones. And it's easy to say, hey, ISO certification, is that really required or is it not required? But again, credit to the team and credit to the founder of going through the first rigmarole and the challenge of getting those ISO certifications. So we're 9001 certified and 17100. But then quickly getting up to speed, or personally me getting up to speed on the importance of those. And the importance really came from, again, it was kind of demand driven. So we were able to service some of our clients because we had those certifications and they were required to service those clients. So then right away it made sense. Okay, this is a business cost that we need to have because it allows us to continue doing business for those specific clients. But then also just being having those standards in place to say or to prove to ourselves and to our clients that we are operating with efficiencies, but we're operating under documented procedures and we do things right and by the book. And I think it's helped me actually understand the business better because we had such great documentation of our processes and workflows internally. So the team can communicate to me, who's an outsider who didn't know anything about translations before I came into the industry. I should say that I grew up bilingual. My mother is French Canadian. So the French Canadian is near and dear to my heart. I actually grew up French first in French school. And speaking English second. My father was an Anglophone, and he was a salesman and traveled extensively. And he would come home and be like talking to me in English. And he's like, I'd be talking to him in French. And he's like, what happened here? Mm-hmm. So it was great. I grew up bilingual, and I have an extensive French Canadian family in the capital region in Quebec. So I was always partial, I guess, and passionate about bilingualism and being cognizant of other people's cultures and traveling the world. I'm a world traveler with my wife and kids as well. Getting back to the whole importance of the ISO certification was to prove that what we did was high quality and that we had the right processes and the rigor to control quality. It's extremely important for us.
Sometimes it could be an overkill. Like if you have only one small banking customer asking you for SOC 2 Type 2, for instance, and it's going to cost you $150,000 to put together, and it's a small company, you probably start to think, is this really feasible for me? Weighing in, you know, if I have like 20 customers and I've got a boatload of money coming out of it, fine. You know, but you gotta measure things. I get the passion to, you know, help people in language connections, etc. But at the end of the day, it's a business. Yeah, I mean, we do it for a reason, to make sure that people are communicating together. But we look at it from a ledger. We look at it from a financial statement, I'm assuming, right?
Right. And yes, I can't get away from my financial mind. So I have things that, like, okay, let's get at this from a P&L perspective, I think is what you're getting at. And it is that it's a trade-off. It's do I spend that to continue this business? And what does that spend unlock for me opportunistic wise, but also on the existing client base? And so we continue to review that and look at that every year. As our clients change and evolve over time, do they still require the same types of certifications, or are they changing or what? So far we've continued to reinvest in those two ISO certifications because they do still make sense to us, but it is absolutely that debate every whether or not we continue to spend that money to keep those going.
My point on the certification is there are general certification, which is very good. Quality standards needs to be in place, needs to be followed. You build the processes around it. When somebody buys something from you that says you're certified under whatever standard is, you know, and you have a degree of trust in that. However, there are some specific certification that they're specific to an industry or a set of clients that if you don't have a large volume of those clients, you start wondering dollars and cents associated with that certification.
Right. Case in point is the healthcare in the US, HIPAA compliance is massive. It's a table stakes requirement to get. And we've actually been an advocate for the technology partners that we partner with to become HIPAA compliant as well, because that is just a gating barrier to entry.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, you're a special person. You know, you came to this industry without, you know, this entire 30 years of assumption baked into the industry, into you, right? So you came fresh to this, right? From outside, you're looking at it, dollars and cents. You mentioned financials and looking at, you know, the P&Ls of everything that you do and how does it impact the bottom line. What was the one thing about how the LSPs, how they operate that generally surprised you, and you something that you seem to, from now that you are on the inside, some people they accept it the way it is, but you're thinking, wow, I can't believe they do this.
I wish you asked me that question to think about before.
Pencil that for later if you want.
I think it's kind of back to what you were talking about, like having an outside perspective and bringing those fresh eyes, because I have the privilege, I should say, of just asking a million questions all the time, saying like, why is it that way? Why do we do it that way? Explain to me this, like, why, how do we measure quality in this language pairing and like, or for this type of service? And by asking those questions kind of forces, like the main players on our team internally that have been around for a long time in the industry and are experts at what they do, but may be kind of in the weeds, so to speak. And by me forcing them to like explain things to me and like, please talk to me as a fourth grader, like, how does that work? And by forcing them outside of their kind of comfort zone to kind of explain why they do something helps them realize like, oh wait, there's probably a better way of doing this. And so it helps us discover new ways of doing things and maybe more efficient ways, but also reiterate sometimes why we do things, because then maybe I'll challenge something without having that knowledge across the teams. And so we have I'm adamant that we have very regular cadence meetings with our management team from different areas of the business so that we can cross-pollinate and learn from each other. But also, if I'm saying, why are we doing it that way? Let's just do it that way. If that impacts something that I don't see, I call them my blind spots. My team has the ability to kind of shine the light on my blind spot a lot and say, we don't do it that way because of there's a really good reason of not doing it that way. So I'm sorry to give you kind of a general answer.
No,
that's
fine. That's okay. But, you know, the good news is that you hit the nail on the head. You're from the outside the industry. You got the why already baked into every conversation. You have the luxury of asking why. But for right. somebody like who's been running a company for 30 years, they're supposed to know everything about the business. I'm sure there are blind spots to everybody. But as you mentioned,
you know, another area that this kind of brings to my mind is as I talk to and as I become more and more involved with the industry, I'm now a board member and a treasurer of CLIA, the Canadian Language Industry Association, which you were a former president of. And I serve alongside you on the board, but also involved in the ALC community in the US and other communities around the globe, because we're involved in Europe and the Americas as well. What I've noticed is so many LSP owners or business leaders talking about, how do I change my pitch to resonate with my clients better or with my prospects better? And I feel it's taking me some time, but it's because they're asking for something a little bit different than they used to ask for. Perception has changed. I think the biggest change from all this technology disruption has been perception from our clients or from anyone's clients. Now all of a sudden things should be done really cheap and free and fast and perfect, right? Perceptions are changing so quickly. And that spurs new questions or spurs new demands from the clients. And so what I've noticed is a lot of owners that are operators in our industry is trying to kind of pivot the way that they pitch their service. But I felt like that was, it's lost a little, because what really matters is actually delivering on that pitch. And so if you just change your pitch to say something else and you don't actually you can't fundamentally follow through on that, then you're going to be unsuccessful because you're,
The trust factor goes away.
The trust factor goes away, or you've changed something, or you've manipulated the way that you explain something. So it sounds like you do something, but you're truly not delivering that value proposition. So what we, again, back at to explain just kind of our strategy or how we came up with our strategy and figuring out that foundation and those pillars that I explained earlier, was really being kind of purposeful in how we lean into what we can do for our clients, and even calling out the stuff that we can't do. And by listing out those, we were able to go, okay, let's go find partners that can help us fill those gaps, because that's important for our clients or the clients that we're after. And if we can't follow through on that, then we're nothing. And so it was more of a fundamental shift in what we're doing and like our operations, as opposed to just a sales and marketing pitch pivot, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, from a growth strategy for Stillman, what is your growth strategy for Stillman right now? Organic, M&A? I've seen you on the M&A panel at the CLIA, so I thought you probably have two-prong approach to growth, right? Organic and acquisition. Am I correct?
You are correct. I maybe to my own demise, I always have multiple balls in the air. I am a financial guy at my heart. And so I have options are always my favorite thing. Having many options.
Options are good. Never go to bed with one option. You have to have several options before you go to bed.
That's right. And so, so yes, building our focusing on our core business, our translation localization business, still core to what we do. We still want to build that out. And we view the best way of building out that side of our business is through M&A transactions with maybe smaller or medium-sized LSPs that are either in that demographic that's ready to retire and move on and maybe transition their operations, or taking on some Rolodexes of clients that those owners of those businesses are just maybe not prepared to continue to serve, or not not their ability to serve them in a more technology forward fashion is changing so fast or has changed that they can't keep up. And so what we do offer a lot of our LSP clients that ability to be a little bit more tech forward. And now we're seeing a little bit of interest to say, well, maybe it makes sense for you guys to just take on this business and maybe it's not for me. So we see that a little bit resonating. Haven't closed any transactions recently on that. But it is an area of, or a focus of, or like you asked me, what's the strategy? So the traditional translation business is through acquisition. Building out our new strategic vision for healthcare, life sciences, and legal on the integrated language operation solutions with the technology partners that we've developed over the last 18, 24 months is very much an organic growth strategy. We are a distribution arm of some of these technology companies, and we are really excited about the blue sky opportunities, because that is not, we had to be very careful. Maybe I'll backtrack a minute. We had to be very careful not to compete with our core business, because we provide services.
You don't want to cannibalize it.
Can't cannibalize it. Don't want to do that. We value those clients extremely well. But what we had to figure out was, or what we realized was, a lot of them are focused on marketing content, helping global businesses or businesses expand into global markets, helping them in the marketing and the content of their communications, and stuff like that. And so where we decided to focus is on more of these regulated markets where we can provide opportunities for language access and accessibility and communications in areas that they never dreamed of being able to do before, because now we have the ability to do that. And so that's where we see these blue sky opportunities that don't cannibalize our core business of traditional translations. And we can also implement our content creation and design skills as well there. And so that's kind of the organic growth strategy, is to push into these sectors, these highly regulated sectors, and enable these organizations to do things at scale, and basically provide more accessibility in areas that they never dreamed of before.
And where do you sit on the idea of buying revenue versus acquiring revenue through client, direct client acquisition?
Sorry, what do you mean? Like
buying revenue, meaning I buy a company for its revenue versus I hire a salesperson to go and get me that revenue.
So this would be the differences to the two strategies I just explained. So
yes.
Buying revenue would be very much aligned with my strategy to grow our traditional business. So that
okay.
would be not looking to buy an operating company, not looking to take on the overhead. It's more bringing in that
the book revenue, of business, basically.
The book of business, yes. And so we have some creative strategy to do that with anyone that's interested in pursuing those. We've had several discussions with different folks about those different strategies, and they mm-hmm. can be quite creative in how they're structured. So open to all sorts of conversations around those. And then investing in pushing into these new markets is much more of an internal investment, and developing mm-hmm. our brand strategy as well as our go-to-market strategy, and our really just being kind of ambassadors for those services that we're trying to take to those different industries that are separate and apart from our traditional business.
Staying on the acquisition topic, I've got one last question for you. Mm-hmm. From a capital market structure standpoint, and I've interviewed a few people here from, I just interviewed somebody from New York last week. I'd published it. They are in the capital market. So they raise capital for companies. That's their job. And you've watched PE money, private equity money, move throughout lots of industries. Where do you think the LSP market is in terms of its consolidation cycle right now? Are we early on, mid, or late? There's the wave is still coming. Two shapes, perhaps. Who survives at the end? So.
Yeah, this is a difficult question. I am at my true core, I'm an optimist, but my past experience in the distressed markets gives me a lot of pessimism as well, because I've seen a lot of distressed stuff. And so it's a little hard to nail down. And I think it's going to be a bit of tale of two worlds. So LSPs that are not adopting new technologies, not thinking forward, not listening to the client's needs and addressing true business challenges and requirements are going to have extreme headwinds in terms of valuations and potential even getting any kind of transaction done. Because if I were to look at a traditional translation localization provider that's truly just a vendor to their clients, how do I buy into the future revenue cash flows of that business? It's very unpredictable and super risky in my mind. But if that company still had that same existing clients, but they were more consultative, they were more implementing some efficiencies, maybe tying together or integrating some sort of workflow or process with that client and delivering some value add other than just the fundamental translation projects, there might be some additional value that you can attribute to that, and maybe a little de-risk that revenue stream. And so there could be a potential to continue those. So yes, we're in an extremely fragmented industry, but so fragmented that there are big players, there are small players, there are tech advanced players, there are like,
I tell you, like, you know, I've been advising companies who are in the investment firms in buying into the industry. And I get those questions on a weekly basis. It's the typical standard, you know, they book me up for a call. I try to get my opinion on what do you think of buying, you know, technology A in the, or company A in the industry. And through the conversation, you come to understand that The idea is pretty simple. We buy into an industry that's not fully automated. They have not yet taken advantage of the technology that they're coming out. We'll automate the heck out of it, and we increase the value of it, and then we sell it. And so basically, back to your how you started in the industry, basically, they're doing the same. They're coming in.
A little bit.
Yeah, they're coming in. They're saying, okay, well, there's a lot of things here that this industry, we can prop up in terms of the processes, in terms of the way they operate, in terms of the cost cutting and the, not just cost cutting, in terms of cost efficiency and cost savings, where we can now create some value from this organization. And a few years later, we can get like 5-10x on the sale.
So there's, you just touched on the key piece to that is, okay, what multiple am I going to pay for this business today? And then can I grow the business? And that might be through efficiencies and reducing overhead and growing the revenue of that business. But in 5-10 years time, am I going to get the same multiple I paid for it? Or can I unlock multiple expansion? So if I pay 2x, 3x, 5x, whatever it is today, can I get 10x, 20x, 5-10 years down the road? Because that's the true ROI. Like that's when you're generating alpha and you're truly creating value. And so that's what a traditional hardcore capital markets guy like my old self is going to look at. He's going to say, can I buy this business for X today? But when I sell it down the road, what things can I unlock to unlock that multiple expansion and actually really get true value out of this thing? And it's always with the grain of salt of like, how do I de-risk this thing as much as I possibly can? I don't want to take on too much risk because it's all about risk-adjusted returns.
Now, I've seen a lot of these transactions go on EBITDA based on, multiplier based on EBITDA versus the old tech sector where they used to have multipliers based on revenue. And however, I've seen a few LSPs trying to sell their companies because in their mind, it is so big, it's so interesting, it's so whatever qualification they got, they throw in there and say, oh, no, I want multiplier based on revenue. How can a service company do that?
So this is a funny question. And
it is a funny question.
In the hallways of capital markets, people literally joke about what's the worst thing you can do as a startup is actually to have profits, to make profits. Because then as soon as you make a profit, the valuation metric goes to your EBITDA or your cash flow generation ability. But if you're pre-profitability, you're spending, and just trying to grow this revenue. And that's where we see all these unicorns that have come from the tech sector, especially because it was mass investment, because the market potential was so big, but they were pre-profitability. So there was no way of traditional academic valuation metrics. And so you put a multiple on revenue and it's massive. Right. And so it's a bit of a game. But I think what you're kind of explaining is really the differences between like early stage startup mass potential growth opportunity, and then companies that are established, profitable, and what is their growth? What is their kind of like value? So it's like value versus growth, kind of thing. Like just like anything else in capital markets, if you're investing in stocks, are you looking at growth stocks or value stocks? And value stocks, you're looking at like multiples of those profitability margins, and growth stocks, you're looking at how big can this how much of the total addressable market can they tap into? And so I think that's the rub that you just described. And so I think it goes back to kind of a tale of two worlds or two types of businesses. Am I looking at a business that is I can unlock value in it and grow it extensively because maybe they have a niche focus in an area that has a moat and you're going to be able to grow that business and they just haven't invested enough, or maybe they're just early stages and you can actually grow that business quite extensively in that niche that they're in. Or are they established for such a long time that they're really just, it's like the growth curve is kind of flattened out on them. And so you're not expecting the revenue necessarily to grow, but now how much efficiency can I get out of that business to grow the bottom line from the same kind of level of revenue?
Now, moving on to the next topic, if you don't mind, Brogan, you're mentoring students at Ivy Business School, where I took my executive development training at Ivy years ago. No, I can't remember when, but years ago, yeah, I spent some time doing that through the Irving organization. They had a partnership with the University of Western Ontario, and everybody who was an executive at the company needed to go through that training. So yes, me and a few people in the organization went and took, well, they put us through the training. It was quite costly. I remember they paid a lot of money for this, and I still have the certificate here somewhere. But anyway, the next generator operators of executives that you're talking to, and thank you for doing this, mentoring students, it's a noble thing. And we should all do this. We should all be part of it. When a smart MBA student asks you whether to build a career in the language industry in 2026, knowing what AI is doing in the market, what do you actually tell them? I don't want you to be worried kind of an answer, but what do you actually tell? The honest one.
Again, great questions. I just to kind of backtrack, my involvement with Ivy Business School is, I think I get more out of it than the students do. It's such great. I'm a true believer in just like continual education throughout life. Like, I will always be a student of something, always learning something new. And this was a fantastic opportunity to actually give back. I originally met a professor at the Ivy School of Business that researched and delivered a transformational leadership course in the Ivy MBA program. And it just struck to my core of, it was all about leadership character. And so I got involved in that just one class as a mentor to the students in that class. And then I got introduced to the faculty and then invited to be an entrepreneur in residence, where I help teams of MBA and HBA or undergrad students develop new venture concepts and create pitches. And then I'm a dragon in the dragon's den at the end, and I get to judge them. And I'm not allowed to ask too many hard questions on finance, but I wish I could. but to your question about what kind of advice I would give a student or an MBA student asking about our specific industry or the language services industry, I still love it. I still think it's fantastic. I still think it checks all those boxes that I was originally looking for. The sandbox is only getting bigger, I think, because it's unlocking some of these technologies that is, yes, disrupting to the old traditional model of what we used to deliver, forced, I think, everyone to realize, like, let's not just be a vendor. Let's not be a commodity. Let's think forward and see what kind of value we can provide to clients in addition to all the wonderful things that naturally come with language access and translation services. And so I think I encourage them to look at the industry, because they come with it through a different tint of glass. And I'm not sure if it's rose colored or what, but
that's the outside looking in again, Brogan.
Again, the outside looking in. So the generation that is coming through business school these days and undergrad are so just advanced in the way that they adopt technology, and they can see different applications of technology and stuff like that. And they are not beholden to doing one thing anyway, because they just don't know any different. So you get some really great insights from these students and some great kind of optimism about what they could do in the industry or what technology could do to change the industry. But they are very cognizant that you can't just put all your chips in one basket and can't just rely on technology at face value. And so having that that kind of next layer of understanding that technology has to come with one layer of trust, but maybe not just full trust, allows them to come up with some pretty incredible ideas. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And we're talking about it on this channel. We talk about it on every episode, to be honest with you. Every conversation I've had on this channel is the same episode. What is your value? What is your expertise? Where is, and I did one on Defensible Zone, where you are going to map. As an individual, we have to map out our individual defensible zone. Where are our skills that we have that nobody can take away from us? Every one of us has those. We cannot focus anymore on being hamsters in the wheel, meaning I'm only specialized in doing data entry on a specific software. Your job is gone. I can't do that anymore. All this conversation that I've had here for the past 3 years on this podcast, saying the same thing. You cannot be no longer tell your boss that I'm the only one specialized and knows how to operate Salesforce. Guess what? I can build an MCP server for you in 5 minutes that will handle that. I don't need you. So what are the skills? I can analyze the data better. I can see what things in the data that other people cannot see. I can have a more time with my conversation with individual, be it customer or internal teams, that nobody's going to take away from you. Your core skills, it has to go back to your core skills. I did this three workshops in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. And the biggest question was, again, the same question that people in Canada are asking, students in Canada are asking, they're being asked everywhere in the world. We're not the only country impacted by this, and it's not special to London, Ontario, or Toronto, mm-hmm. or Montreal. This is across the globe, a phenomenon that is taking place. However, there are some countries are adapting to this a lot better than we are here in Western world. I was just talking to somebody who just came back from Singapore, for instance. The policy around the adoption of new technology and AI in general, it is amazing how much room the innovators are being given to deploy these technology, not in the digital world only, in the physical world. Like you would see robots walking amongst a human. You would see more robots in restaurants serving you or bringing you coffee or these things here in the Western world. We put a lot of regulation and policies around it. All this to say is as individuals, we need to figure out what makes us different. And, you know, we've been told this since we were kids going to school. What makes you different? Don't do what everybody else in class does. Your parents, my parents told me the same. Figure out what makes you good at something and stick to that. And I think this is the time for us as a humanity to continue doing this.
Yes, I would agree. And I think we talk a lot about internally on our management teams and some of our advisors is talking about our individual superpowers. And it's kind of exactly what you're talking about is what do you bring that is unique and different and that you excel at and that you do better than anybody else? And I think that's an important kind of team leadership thing, too, is that we instill that in everyone at Stillman, and we look for people that when we're looking to add people to our team that bring kind of that three-dimensional thinking
process.
Yeah, but also like without the blinders on, like I'm not here just to like punch keys and do one job. I'm here to think about what I'm doing and add value across the organization, and technology helps do that because it takes away kind of the keystroke maybe that lets you fall into that maybe that gap of just plugging away at something without thinking and being too caught up in that before thinking, like stepping back and thinking big picture and saying, okay, this could be done better. And mm-hmm. I'm doing this because it has this outcome and this could help our clients or help our organization run better.
Sure. Yeah. Since you talk leadership, one last question and we'll start wrapping it up here. I know we're over time. You have two sons. You're keeping active. You relocated your life to London, Ontario from Toronto. You're running a business operations across three continents. And I mean, this takes a different kind of pressure altogether from advising boards, etc. What changed in how you think about leadership? I mean, there's a lot of listeners on the podcast who are leaders building companies or, you know, veteran leaders have been around for many, many years leading companies. What did you have to change from a leadership style now that you're in the company's yours, you're not a client of the company anymore. So you had to think about it a little differently. What changed on how you lead companies?
I think maturity, maturing through the leadership process and really leaning into the character of a leadership. So character of a leader and having trust in your team. And so I am a very, I trust until I don't, or I have a reason not to trust. And so giving the team and believing in your team that they are the right people that have their superpowers that will, if you combine them all, is like unstoppable. And so I think I'm very fortunate in having a team that I can completely trust in. We test each other, we challenge each other, and we see each other's blind spots. And so I think what helped for me growing into and evolving into the leader I am today is having the maturity to say, what do I do really well? What do I not do really well? And how could I do things better? And being open to feedback and maybe some constructive feedback from even your own team members that say, I know that you like to work this way, but it doesn't work for us or this needs to change. So being open to change is really important.
Thank you, Brogan. I really appreciate it. Last question. If someone's listening today and they are currently running an LSP or a small company or in a language space of any sort, being a team leader, let's say inside of an enterprise, head of localization department, what is the one thing you want them to take away from this conversation, Brogan?
I think it would be to get involved and be a part of the conversation in the industry. There's tremendous disruption going on. There's a lot of anxiety around at different companies, but being part of CLIA is fantastic for me. It gives me an outlet to share with some other LSP owners and executive level folks, but just getting involved in those industry associations, industry events, talking to other peers and fellow leaders to understand what their challenges are and share. I think being open and transparent and sharing is the best way to come up with creative and new ideas on how to solve challenges and overcome obstacles.
And where can people find you, connect with you, learn a little bit more about what Stillman is building or does?
You can reach out to me directly. Or you can check out our websites. So stillmanst.com is our Stillman Solutions team website. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm active on LinkedIn and happy to reciprocate with a profile or a connection. And you can reach out to me at brogan.taylor@stillmanst.com.
And for those who are interested after this listening to this conversation, connecting to Brogan, if you can't find him, just reach out to me and I'll connect you. I'll do an introduction for you, no problem. That's what I'm here for. And happy to connect whoever wants to connect with Brogan. Brogan, this is great, man. I really enjoyed this conversation.
So did I. Thank you so much again, Robin.
I want to thank you so much for joining me, Brogan Taylor, CEO of Stillman. I really appreciate your time with me. A little over an hour. Hopefully, I didn't take you away from other meetings. But we're wrapping up pretty quickly here. I really appreciate it. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on this recording, episode 246. And I really appreciate your journey on not just for this episode, but for all the episodes that you've joined me with. And also, I want to thank you for watching us on YouTube, on the podcast channels, on downloading the app. Where now we have one app where you can find all the content in the single location. You can watch, listen, read, whatever you want. And you don't need to really try to find us. It's called the app, app.l10nfiresidechat.com. And you can check it out on your browser, on your mobile, and just press add, and it will become your home, part of an icon on your home screen where you can find all the information that you want. Thanks, everybody, and I will see you at the next recording. I'll see you at the next episode. We'll talk later. Bye-bye.